One.
You are listening to the weekly Cybersecurity Podcast, episode 12, summarizing security news and items of interest for the week ending the 19th of August 2016. So let's get started. I'm Stuart from Velocity in Hong Kong.
And I'm Brendan from the ABSH Group in Melbourne, Australia.
If this is your first time listening, thanks for coming. Our aim is to produce this every week. Come back often and feel free to add this to your favorite podcast app. Well, I'll begin today with a quick errata. We had mistakenly mentioned last week that the vehicle wireless hack was for Volvo, when in fact it was for Volkswagen. It was a bit of a typo in copying it across from the articles to the summary notes that we keep. So if you have a VW vehicle, that may impact you, so have a look at that. Anyway, I guess our biggest topic this week was the news about a supposed NSA hack. You want to lead into that, Brendan?
Yes, absolutely. Probably the not only the largest story, but also the most interesting. It's thought to believe that the Equation Group, who have for a long time been loosely coupled, linked to, and thought to be potentially a division or wing of the NSA, had one of their staging malware servers compromised, and the hackers, believed to be shadow brokers, a previously unknown hacking group who were thought to be Russian, stole a whole swag of tools, zero-day exploits, and vulnerabilities, and then decided to release them publicly. We've had both Cisco and FortiGate come out publicly and confirm that some of the zero-day attacks and vulnerabilities are actually vulnerabilities within their iOS and provide workarounds and solutions, and they've certainly committed to a couple of patches that are not quite out yet, but certainly I guess bad news for us, because it now means that those exploits and vulnerabilities are known and public and available to all hacking groups to utilize.
Yeah, I think this was also just a few bits of it released as proof that they actually had this too. So I think they're still up for auction, as far as I'm aware, for the rest of the stuff that they got.
A little larger than a few bits.
Yeah, so it's
but you're right. They
are
auctioning them off. I think they wanted, was it $1 million in bitcoins?
$1 million in bitcoins, and they would actually release the whole thing publicly, I think, was what they said.
Yeah. So. Quite scary.
I love the names that that the Equation Group use. Those sort of epic banana and extra bacon, and sort of interesting names that they use for their exploit code.
A bit concerning that some of these exploits are from 2011, 2010, 2012, 2013.
Yeah, and still, you know, obviously they've had a long time to use these if these remain unpatched for the last sort of 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. Crazy, crazy stuff. I mean, you take the extra bacon, which was a vulnerability in Cisco ASA's SNMP module that allowed remote code execution. So basically, using a buffer overflow, they could not only inject their own code, but they could actually reload the running configuration of that device.
Yeah, basically, and take it over.
Yeah, like that's just epic. I mean, remember, I don't know if you remember, I can't remember if it was this year or maybe middle of last year, there was a massive data breach found with Cisco equipment, and it was to do with transatlantic core routers, and they, you know, it was all thought that it was Chinese spying on us and all this kind of stuff. I don't know if it hit Hong Kong, but it was certainly in Australia. And they weren't quite, they couldn't quite work out how those Cisco routers had been compromised. This could potentially be one of the ways or one of the vulnerabilities that was used.
Yeah, of course, the interesting thing about this, at least from my understanding of how Equation Group had worked, and this is going back to obviously some of the discussions that were after Edward Snowden had come out of the cold, where they had staging servers based around the world, where the whole point of it was to respond to be a man in the middle between someone and, for example, a website that they might be able to interested in going to, and of course they would then respond faster than the legitimate website, which meant that, you know, traffic would then go to them because they had these staging servers that were really close to potential targets. And of course, if you have a staging server obviously outside of the United States in order to do these kinds of things, then there is the possibility that someone can find out where that is and you know, do their own little game around it. And that's probably what's happened here.
Yeah, I mean, you can't if you want to win the game, you've got to take the risk, right?
That's right.
It's so, like the NSA must have their own little CDN.
I'm sure they do. You know, they must have, you know, the fact that it's been widely reported that, you know, they probably have thousands of servers around the world. That's part of their system. Mm.
So I guess for those that are running Cisco firewalls, routers, the Epic Banana vulnerability was to do with the command line interface. That was patched in 2011. So if you do have Cisco routers with software version 8.4.1 or earlier, make sure that you upgrade them. The extra bacon, which is the SNMP remote code execution vulnerability, there is no current patch released from Cisco. However, they have said to either disable SNMP and or enable it, but to a trusted host. So lock it down to an internal machine that's needing to query it, or an external if that's what you're doing. Ideally, if you're going to query SNMP externally, you probably want to be doing that over a VPN, but maybe use cases where that's not possible or not supported.
Basically apply current best practices.
Yeah, definitely. Without a doubt. I mean, when we configure firewalls and routers and things, you know, we take a conservative approach. We disable everything first and then enable things as required. And I think, you know, the world would be a safer place if everyone kind of used that philosophy and mentality. And yes, it does take slightly longer to configure, but it ultimately results in a much more secure deployment.
Indeed. Anyway, moving on, we have a nice little report about the five most common ways pen testers gain access
into systems. I love the fact that these guys have released this data publicly and that it's real world data, because I have long believed that this was the case, and I've gone out and told clients this and no one has ever listened. They're like, no, we don't have any people that do that. But now that there is actual data, it is just fantastic.
Yeah, this is good, and this is why these kinds of reports are useful too, because it does actually say, you know, it tells people, you know, what has been working, and we've actually reported on a few reports over the last few podcasts, and you know, these I find actually fascinating because they do give you sort of real world, as you said, examples of what actually works and doesn't, and what's going on. So it's great that, you know, people continue to share this information. Anyway, sort of going down the list, obviously the number one is abuse of weak domain user passwords. Gee, what a surprise.
So just to recap, this was a penetration testing company released a report advising people of all the things that they test when they do pen testing. What are the top five things that they use in order to break in? And it started with, like you just said, Stuart, weak domain passwords. So that's passwords that are either, you know, what would you say, less than 8 characters, Stuart? Don't use a mix of numbers, letters, and symbols.
Yeah, typical sort of traditional passwords. You know, I remember, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but, you know, with some of the breach information that's come out in the last few years, you know, the most common password was often still, you know, 123456, or, you know, ABC123, and, password, you know, monkey123 and stuff like that. So they still, you know, often, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, it's inside the domain, or what's it matter, you know, no one's going to be able to break in, blah, 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 so so users often, and this is bearing in mind here that this is user passwords, you know, because obviously, you know, this is not necessarily domain admin, so these are everyday users, so you can try and sort of get in on in terms of the users. So a common thing might be first name and you know, 123 or month of the year or all those kinds of things as well. So and just going back to the actual report writers, so it's, the group is actually Praetorian, which is a fairly big pen testing company that's been around for quite a while. So, you know, these are coming from people that do this, and I believe this is based out of over 100 pen testing attacks of recent months, years.
And they're larger organizations, right? It's, we're not talking, you know, 10, 20 user sites here. We're talking serious businesses that are paying Praetorian to come in and you know, do proper penetration testing from both internal and external.
Oh, indeed. You know, it's, we've got one of our clients recently that did engaged a this is their global entity. We look after their local aspects. They also included physical penetration, so they actually have people that try to actually get inside the building and walk away with IT equipment. I won't comment much more than to say that they were successful in some locations.
And the client, no doubt, disappointed. What about the number two, Stuart? What was the number two?
Broadcast name resolution poisoning. So this is basically injecting something into a network where you intercept the broadcast. So you basically say, I'm the person you want to talk to, and computers will then come back to you and give you information. So it's not a simple thing necessarily to do, although obviously there are probably tools that do this fairly straightforwardly these days. But it's a little bit like, you know, ARP poisoning and so on.
Well, Windows by default, right? Windows Server, when it detects another DHCP server on the network, it turns itself off.
Certainly SPS does. The enterprise servers don't, because you can have multiple DHCP servers on a segment.
Yes, sorry, you're very true.
Third one, you want to take that one?
Local admin password attacks. So that was compromising the local machine and then often users cache their password, whether that's for their email or for their browser, etc., and basically stealing those credentials and then using them against the domain.
Yeah, particularly too, and this is one of the interesting things, if you can get access to Windows's SAM database, which is their security database, there are tools that enable you to do hash lookups on this kind of thing. So this would be, I don't know whether they can do this from the kinds of attacks that they do, but certainly if you have a cached local admin, this was a local admin password, so this is actually a local admin on the machine, which obviously then gives them full access rights to a specific machine. So this is not a cached domain password, but that would be another thing to potentially use, I guess, once you've got full admin access.
Yeah, definitely. I remember reading this week that CryptoLocker is now, ransomware, some of the new strains are now also stealing the SAM database if successful, so that they can then re-attack the target. So, you know, whilst, like you've mentioned, this is a local admin password in this instance, I guess the key takeaway is don't set the local admin passwords on the computers to be the same as your domain admin or
domain admin password. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Attacks on clear text was number four. So clear text passwords in memory. That surprised me, to be honest, because that's a fairly advanced attack. I guess most apps typically do, whilst dealing with in-memory transactions, don't bother encrypting the data. It's encrypted at rest, but not during transit. That would need, though, they'd need...
You'd already have to have... Yeah, you've already got onto the machine, so presumably it starts off with a phishing attack or something along those lines, and then they're pivoting that into escalated privileges on the machine itself and then ultimately on the domain.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And number five...
insufficient network segmentation. I know, obviously, in large networks, this is extremely important that you break the network down into bits. In fact, even with some of our smaller clients, we do this to, you know, obviously keep backup systems and management aspects of the network off the user space so that they do not have access to it in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, the report, obviously, you can read in greater detail, but, you know, micro-segmentation now is one of the philosophies that is certainly being used in larger organizations where you break the network down into very small pieces so that if one area gets compromised, the entire corporation doesn't necessarily get taken down.
Yeah. And then, obviously, you're locking your users down too, correct? So,
you know, that's right.
Yeah. If the person from the sales team gets compromised, whilst it may take some of your information, a lot of that information is likely to be public domain anyway. But because they can't see the finance or can't see the the management area, they limit their exposure. And that's probably really important from being able to report when you are compromised as to what was stolen, what was taken. It's probably a much stronger position to be in to walk in and say, listen, yeah, we were compromised and they were able to get access to XYZ system, as opposed to, look, we really don't know, but they got everything, we assume.
I
think Australia is looking at having mandatory breach reporting shortly too. I know there's a bill in Parliament at the moment, so we don't have it at the moment, but
What are they class as a breach? Because that's obviously an interesting perspective as well, or question.
Discussion from another podcast.
Yeah, I imagine so. Because, you know, one of the things with some of our finance clients, you know, for example, in Singapore, if you get a crypto ransomware attack, you have to report that to the authorities. Whereas in Hong Kong, there's no requirements.
So
it's quite different in terms of the reporting requirements. I guess we can go over the recommendations. So obviously basic stuff is strengthen passwords, obviously increase the Active Directory password length, because the shorter it is these days, the easier it is to do a hack, a brute force attack on it. Enhance password policy, basically expirations and so on. Obviously, if we can implement two-factor authentication for all administrator access and remote access. You want to go on then?
Yeah, so to mitigate the broadcast name resolution poisoning, populate DNS servers with entries for all known valid resources, and disable LLMNR and NetBIOS. Certainly, you basically want to try and reduce the reliance on automatic configurations, because obviously those automatic configurations can be faked.
Abused.
Yeah, great word. And finally, improve network segmentation. That's probably the last step you want to tackle, because it is it's a lot more complicated, and typically it does result in some downtime if everything is one big network. So you want to try and tackle that last, but certainly worthwhile for larger networks, or even, like you said, you know, I know for even our smallest clients, all backup systems are sitting on a separate subnet, and in some instances even separate physical switching, so that it's completely isolated.
Yeah, exactly. We do the same with like a management backup network.
Yeah,
it's a different switch. It's not even VLAN. It's a physical isolation.
Because you never know when there's going to be some kind of zero-day VLAN that allows you to cross.
Moving on.
We had a couple of other reports this week as well. There was one from Kaspersky.
Yeah, so this was a report on a wave of attacks on commercial entities by cyber criminals. So this isn't crypto malware, which has obviously taken the core of the news of recent times. This was actually still obviously based around phishing to get into companies. But in this case, what they're actually attempting to do is to get inside the network and then exfiltrate intellectual property and business intelligence, which they can then sell on the dark web. So this is still obviously commercially driven. but it's not driven around sort of holding stuff to ransom. It's actually getting it and then selling the information. And it's been a target of over 130 companies in a variety of different countries. And it's primarily industrial and engineering, but also have targets including things like pharmaceutical manufacturing, basically people with intellectual property and business secrets to steal. And it's actually one of the interesting components of this one is actually the malware that they're using is based on a commercial package that you can buy called Hawkeye. So I guess this is where anything can be turned to nefarious purposes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, you're taking the tools of the trade that, you know, typically the spies and governments use, and then applying them to business in order to monetize it. Kind of a natural progression. There's certainly a larger attack market. I guess the question is, how do you identify clients that have commercially sensitive information that they don't want stolen? But like you said there, I mean, shipping, pharmaceutical, manufacturing, health, trading, financial companies.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Well, it's all people with things like patented technology, or maybe even pre-patent, commercial secrets. Maybe industrial it could be industrial processes. It could be time-sensitive stuff. It could be there's all sorts of things that they could be going after here. Mm. So it's obviously since it is still based on a phishing email phishing to get into the networks, it comes back to. Training users against falling for phishing attacks. So it comes back again to sort of the end user training because these are obviously very targeted attacks.
Like you said, it's typically not a technology failure but a human failure. The weakest link is the people, so train your people. You have to give them the tools they need in order to be able to identify these types of attacks if you want to thwart it as best you can.
Definitely. Going into some news bites.
Yeah, so, lots of malware news bites.
Yeah, a few there. So first one there is Lockheed's been having a big campaign targeting hospitals and a massive wave of ransomware attacks targeting US, Japan, Korea and Thailand. It's a macro-enabled Office 2007 document, and obviously you open the document and then downloads the next components of the thing. Also some targeting on telecom and transportation and manufacturing, but primarily healthcare, unfortunately. And obviously each email campaign has a specific one-off campaign code. So it's they're very, very much going down the route almost of commercial marketing in some ways, and the way they do things with campaigns and different things that they're doing.
They've said for a long time it's a business and it has distribution and resellers and like any other market and any other business does.
Yeah. One interesting point here, Lockheed is ranked as the top malware threat according to Proofpoint, which is obviously one of the big groups that deal with anti-malware stuff. And more ransomware than banking trojans, as ransomware is more lucrative, especially in healthcare, where they can demand some rather large payouts.
Especially if they don't have good backups.
Moving on then, there's a brand new ransomware software as a service. Now, this was actually, I don't know whether it was pioneered, but certainly this year has become very prevalent with one called Serbit, where basically you have the virusware of the crypto ransomware writers, and then they don't get involved in the distribution and money laundering side of things. So basically they say, here, you guys take it. This is a business that you can now start up, and we want a cut of the proceeds. Well, Shark has apparently decided to follow that particular model, and they want 20% of profits that you make from it, and they actually distribute this through a professional looking website that features information about the ransomware and instructions on how to download and configure it. key takeaway, obviously, here is the underground professional services market continues to develop. So stay tuned here. This is really becoming sort of interesting in one way and scary in another. It's really developing into a professional services industry.
Yeah, I mean, how simple, right? You want to make some money and you're, I don't know, 18, 19, 20. You go to the site, you download the application, you put in your minimum ransom and you add a couple of variables, and then you basically send it out.
Email it out.
Yeah, and they take a 20% clip. They take the risk mostly. You know, they're the guys that are the writing it and providing the ransom as a service. They're managing the payment gateway. They're managing the malware staging servers. They're managing the code to make sure it's constantly updated to, you know, bypass your various antivirus vendors. So it really is like a standard distribution model.
Stay tuned is all I can really say on that. So what else we got?
On the lighter side, there was certainly the story this week that one of the ransomware scammers had messed with another hacker's parents, and so that hacker retaliated with ransomware, infecting the potential scammer's machine with Lockie, of all things. And we're not quite sure, but we suspect it was spreading laterally through the network, encrypting some of the other machines as well. So that's one of the wins for the good guys.
There was a piece of news, I think this came out of DEF CON, or Black Hat, where there was an industrial controller flaw. This is a popular Allen Bradley Rockwell Automation MicroLogic 1400 programmable logic controller. So these are PLCs. These are often used in a lot of industrial processes, everything from pipelines to manufacturing facilities to refineries and the whole works. So this was found by Cisco Talos. Basically, it is an undocumented SNMP community string, and if you manage to use it, you can gain full access to the device and can do basically anything you like, and including uploading your own firmware to it. So this is the stuff that's running our oil and gas pipelines. Yay!
And hopefully on a closed network that's not publicly accessible, right? Behind firewalls.
Of course, of course. What could possibly go wrong connecting it to the internet?
And just before we finish up, this is a great another example of, as the Internet of Things comes to fruition and becomes more and more popular, more and more of these things are going to be brought to our attention. I mean, you look at this. This is a commercial product. Possibly, it's been around for a long time, and hence why there's been a relax on security. And I'm sure they're working on solutions for it now. But you know, there's so many Internet of Things connected devices now with baby cameras and light bulbs, and we've mentioned a number of others throughout our podcast. But they're interested on getting product to market. They're not really interested in securing those products. So you've got to be really, really careful with what you're plugging in, why you're plugging it in, and if you are, making sure it is locked down to only your internal network and behind a firewall, and all your standard best practices are put in place, because, you know, like you said, some fairly...
It's unfortunate with these particular ones too, because what's probably happened at some point is, you know, they've all been isolated PLCs, there was no network for it, and you know, and someone's come along and said, wouldn't it be great if we could get all the information and control these remotely? And of course, the simplest thing to do is probably to hook up an internet access, you know, at all these remote locations, and, you know, then people can dial in from the main office. And you know, when some of these things were set up, you know, they're probably literally plugged in raw to the internet, or, you know, through a very simple system that allowed for outside access using, you know, SNMP or whatever other protocol that was enabled. So this was a, you know, at the time it sounded like a good idea, and of course then reality bites.
Yep, I know of a prominent Australian government body that was producing certain devices with 4G connections, and have recently switched those 4G connections to like an MPLS style. So yes, they're still 4G, but they're sitting on a private network going back to the government department. as opposed to being public. And I'm sure there was a cost saving initially, which is why they must have chosen that. But then when they saw the risk, I suspect they've decided to switch it around the other way.
Probably wraps us up, right?
Yep, definitely. I will quickly cover the census because we did promise last week, and I know we're way over time, but just very quickly, the ultimate outcome was IBM didn't protect the site against DDoS, basically. They've apologized publicly. They didn't suspect it was going to happen, and so they didn't have it in, and that was what took the site down. There were three attacks. They were able to absorb three. The fourth attack was larger and coming from Australia, which obviously bypassed any type of geo IP blocking. And they thought they'd been breached, so they took the site down, and it took a few days for them to bring it back online because they had to get confirmation from the Australian Signals Directorate that the site was safe and a breach hadn't occurred. And IBM obviously had to put in place sufficient DDoS protection. So
does that mean the census has to be done again, or what's the plan around that?
Yeah, so the census is, the site's back online, and people have got till the 19th of September, I believe, to complete it. There's certainly public advertising campaigns seeking people to go and submit it. And there is a hotline for people that thought they had submitted it but had issues with it on the night.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
Excellent. As always, Stuart, thank you very much for your time and for catching up.
We'll talk again.
We will. That covers off the major security-related incidents. Thanks for listening. If you have any topics you'd like us to cover, please feel free to contact either Stuart or myself. Until next week, stay safe.